It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Republican Party reports its list of election workers to staff the polls is three times longer than it was in 2020. It's a sign of emphasis on election integrity following former President Donald Trump's false claims that the election was stolen. As Wisconsin Watch's Jacob Resnick reports, election officials say they are doing their best to reassure voters that the state's upcoming elections will be fair and secure.
Oconto County Clerk Kim Pitleski keeps a series of colorful, hand-drawn posters in her office. On one, she's written in marker, "Perception has become reality." It's a nod to the way election officials like her have come under serious, sometimes ill-informed scrutiny. She wants to reassure people that votes aren't being stolen, despite what they might read on social media.
People are throwing skepticism and these comments out there, but they're not doing the homework on what this really entails.
Frontline election workers are encountering not just questions, but outright hostility. It's fueled by former President Donald Trump's false claims that the 2020 election was stolen. Milwaukee election officials report receiving harassing calls, even death threats, leading officials to beef up security. The Madison metro area is preparing, too. In Stoughton, clerks will have trauma kits and training for active shooter scenarios. City Clerk Candy Christian says Dane County had recommended these precautions.
It's a balance between trying to get our poll workers aware, but also not scare them away from being a poll worker.
One part of the Wisconsin Republican Party's response to the 2020 elections has been to invest in what it calls its Election Integrity Unit. In Green Bay, Brown County Republican Chair Jim Fitzgerald says historically, Republicans didn't recruit many poll workers.
When I came into office 4 years ago here, the list of poll workers I had were probably 90% unaffiliated, with very, very few Republicans. That's just the way it was done back then. You know, you try and have identified Republicans, but it wasn't that big a deal.
But it is a big deal now. And it goes back to what the county clerk in Oconto has said. Perception has become reality. Fitzgerald says his party needs to reassure its base, angry about Trump's defeat.
The issue has never been the 2020 election with us. It's been as a result of the 2020 election and as a result of how people reacted to it, we have to take care of their reactions.
And it's not just symbolic. Wisconsin election law allows whatever party's presidential or gubernatorial candidate that got the most votes at a precinct to nominate an extra election inspector at that polling place. That extra poll worker could be a tie-breaking vote if there's disagreement over whether to accept an absentee ballot questioned on technical grounds. The Republican Party says it sent 5,053 names to local clerks to work the polls, and that's a threefold increase over 2020. State Democratic officials wouldn't say how many party members they've signed up, but they point to their voter assistance hotline for anyone encountering problems at the polls. And while Republican officials may deny that they're focused on 2020, it's clear that some members of the party are angry about the chaos from voting during the first year of the pandemic. Marge Bostelman was county clerk in Green Lake for 24 years. And since 2019, she's been a Republican member of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. She says her experience as a clerk has guided her votes on the commission, even when it contradicts the party line. Things came to a head last year after she voted with Democrats to allow nursing home residents to vote absentee.
They wanted to make it clear that the Green Lake Republican Party denounced me because of my actions on the WEC.
A year later, the lifelong Republican is unrepentant for her work on the commission.
I'm not going to follow what the party wants me to do if it's detrimental for a municipal clerk to run a fair and honest election.
Back in Oconto, Republican County Clerk Pitleski says she's worried about this increasingly winners-take-all mindset in politics.
Because pendulums swing. You know, who's in power, so to speak, that will swing. And we want to write election laws that are in place no matter which political party has the majority, because we all have to play by the same rules on this. Play nice in the sandbox.
Because even in her rural county, political polarization has pitted some neighbors against each other. And she says we can't let our communities be divided this way. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Jacob Resnick in Oconto.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to the Pelican River Forest, east of Rhinelander, the largest land conservation project in state history. The final acreage acquisition got a green light recently from the Wisconsin Natural Resources Board. The Conservation Fund, that's the National Environmental Conservation Group, says it's securing the largest privately owned, unprotected block of forest remaining in Wisconsin. Join in with your thoughts on land preservation, like Pelican River Forest and heavily forested counties, 800-642-1234. Clint Miller is Central Midwest Regional Director for the Conservation Fund, overseeing the fund's work in eight states, including here in Wisconsin. Clint, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. I appreciate it. And thanks for taking the time to learn more about this project.
Yes. So how will the 70,000-acre Pelican River Forest be protected from development under this deal?
So it's a pretty straightforward methodology. It's what we call buy, protect, and then sell. So the Conservation Fund acquired the property about a year ago. We will sell conservation easements, which is an interest in land, to the DNR, and then it will sell the underlying fee to another owner after the property's been protected.
So what is the Pelican River Forest like? Can you describe its features? Why is it so important?
Well, it's a spectacular piece of property, and it's unusual to find commercial timberland that is in one big block like this is. If you can imagine a county the size of Oneida County, which is similar in size to Dane County, and think of the entire southeastern corner made up of this forest. And so the forest itself is a combination of rolling hills, big wetlands. There's 26,000 acres of wetlands on this property, of forested wetlands. There's multiple trout streams. The Wolf River borders the property on the eastern side, and then the Pelican River flows into the Wisconsin River on the west side, and that's actually a divide. So the part of the water that comes off of this property goes into the Great Lakes. The other part of the water goes down the Mississippi drainage. And the forest itself is well-managed commercial timberland. It's got aspen clones and then big upland hardwood forests with big white pines that stick up. So it's a beautiful piece of property.
When you talk about your scheme, your formula of buy, protect, sell, why sell the land rather than keep it in public hands?
So the property's not in public hands. It's been in private ownership for over 100 years. And the case that we're doing is where we're buying the property. We're a private nonprofit organization. We continue to pay the taxes on the property. And that's important for the local community, is that those taxes continue to get paid. So we've acquired the property. We sell the conservation easements, and the conservation easements do two really big things. One is it keeps the forest as forest, meaning a productive forest, something that will that enhance provide opportunities for the forest industry to continue to thrive in that area. And then the second thing is that it secures permanent public access to a series of internal roads. So by the time this is all said and done, there'll be 70 miles of roads that are open inside the property. And then when we sell the property, it again goes back up onto the private marketplace, and then the new landowner will continue to pay the taxes on the property. But the key is that the forest will stay forest, and the roads and the recreation will be recreational. The state doesn't have to own that.
And I want to pick up on the taxes piece, because there is that perception that this type of conservation erodes local property tax bases and shifts tax burdens. What is the impact on this type of deal? What is the impact on the local tax base?
So there's zero impact. I mean, the property is already enrolled into a tax program called the Managed Forest Law, which is a tax abatement program in Wisconsin that thousands of landowners take advantage of. So that level of tax burden will always be there for this piece of property. And in our case, that's $73,000 a year that gets contributed to the local economy.
Could this forest be prone to being divided up, to fragmentation, if there are a bunch of different parties that could potentially have a stake in this land?
So the property, that's the beauty of the conservation easement. The conservation easement places restrictions on the property itself. And so the property cannot be divided more than a few parcels over time. That way it keeps that large block of land ownership together. That's the key piece of a conservation easement.
What is the forest's impact on carbon emissions? Do you know that?
Yeah, it's actually pretty significant. So the Pelican River Forest stores about 19 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent. That's like taking, you know, 4 million passenger vehicles. That's like 4 million passenger vehicles over the course of a year. And then over the next 5 years, with timber harvest and all the work that we continue to do, we're probably going to remove somewhere in the neighborhood of 240,000 to 640,000 metric tons of CO2 from the atmosphere. So it has a very significant impact on carbon.
We're exploring the Conservation Fund's large land purchase in northern Wisconsin. Clint Miller is Central Midwest Regional Director for the Conservation Fund. Join in on how to treat working forests and farmlands. What are the best conservation strategies and why? Thoughts on the conservation easements, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We talk about the Conservation Fund's largest land purchase to date, 70,000 acres of forested wetlands. It's known as Pelican River Forest. According to the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program, the Pelican River Forest will link the Oneida County Forest and the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest. So you're going to straddle the divide between the Lake Superior and the Mississippi River basins. Join in on this land conservation approach, what you think of it, 800-642-1234. Clint Miller is Central Midwest Regional Director for the Conservation Fund and stays with us. Let's take a call now. Bruce in Dodgeville. Bruce, hi, go ahead.
Hi, I think this is a great development, and I just want to follow up on the comments on carbon sequestration. And as I'm sure your expert knows, the carbon that they would be taking out of the atmosphere can earn carbon credits that can be sold on the voluntary carbon market, whether it's the conservation organization or the new owners. This is something that's already going on throughout the United States and throughout the world.
Bruce, thank you for bringing up this point. What is the value, Clint, of carbon credits to the potential new owner?
Well, Kate, I will first say that I'm not an expert in values of the actual dollar values of carbon credits. But Bruce, that's an excellent question. The interesting thing about the carbon side of this is that's who we find to be the new buyers of these large commercial forests. There is a very significant interest in the carbon benefits of these projects. So you can, just as a reminder, you can still cut the forest. You can still do the forestry that's been going on for decades to hundreds of years in these areas, and you can still capture carbon. In fact, a good, healthy forest captures more carbon. The key here is that the new buyers that we may look for when we eventually sell the property, again, remember, we buy it, we protect it, we won't sell it until after it's protected, and then move it into some new hands. The new buyers out there may, rather than be focused on the forest benefits and the benefits of the timber, they're also looking at those carbon credits and the benefits of those carbon. So it's a really important, probably future market for these kinds of properties. But right now we're just focused on the protection side of it, make sure we get that part done.
And I want to dig a little bit more into that delicate balance. You mentioned this is property is well-managed commercial timberland. How, you know, and there's concern that conservation can diminish the key forestry industry in Wisconsin. So how do you strike that balance of keeping the logging and the paper mill capacity in that area competitive and keep those jobs in rural communities?
Yeah, that's a tough one because, you know, one single project itself is not going to dictate what happens to the mills and the forest industry. But collectively, what we can continue to do is to maintain those large blocks of forest like the Pelican River Forest. The Great Lakes region, as many listeners probably know, has seen some real downturns in the forest economy. And some of that is related to fragmentation, these large blocks of forest. And as those large blocks of forest get chopped up into individual lots or into smaller ownership, some people may or may not be interested in commercial timber harvest. And it's hard to for the forest industry to predict how consistent the products that may be coming off the forest are going to be if there's multiple landowners that they're having to deal with. The beauty of having large blocks of forest is there's an opportunity to work with large landowners, and they have more predictability as to the product and how much is coming off.
Talking about land acquisition east of Rhinelander with Clint Miller, Central Midwest Regional Director for the Conservation Fund, as we explore the Pelican River Forest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Steve in La Crosse with a question. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning. See, I think it's a great, great project, and I think it's beautiful for the state to preserve this land. Question is, you had previously mentioned that this property could potentially be divided into a few parcels. Those were your words. I'm curious what those few parcels could be. And then if it's divided into a parcel, can that further be divided into further parcels down the calendar of time?
Steve, thank
you. We'll hang up
yes,
and listen to
appreciate it. Clint, go ahead.
Yeah, Steve, good question. So just to be really clear that there's actually two parts of the project that we're working on. The first part, it's a total of 70,000 acres of land, and there's two conservation easements. The first conservation easement was sold to the DNR earlier this year, and that was on 12,000 acres. And then the second one is 56,000 acres. So there's going to be an opportunity. Should we sell, we could sell two parcels and two separate conservation easements, or we can sell the entire thing and the property still has two conservation easements. The easements typically have a minimum size for the parcels that it can be divided into. So to the answer to Steve's question, no, we can't keep further subdividing all the way down to small parcels, the 40 and 80 acre lots that people can think of when they think of subdivisions.
The Pelican River Forest has to win final approval from lawmakers, from the legislature. How confident are you that lawmakers will agree to the project?
Well, Kate, that's a great question. This is a historic opportunity for legislators to really do something for the citizens of the state of Wisconsin. You know, there's partisan work, there's bipartisan work, and there's nonpartisan work. And we're all familiar with partisan work. The bipartisan work takes things to the next step where people make a concentrated effort to work together. But what we're talking about here is nonpartisan work. This is a project that's inherently neither blue nor red. And what land conservation is it's nonpartisan. And this is truly an epic opportunity for the state legislature to give a thumbs up on a really significant project.
In our last minute together, can we land on recreation, the kinds of recreation that could be permitted within the Pelican River Forest?
Yeah, so right now the property is enrolled in the Managed Forest Law Open, which means that people can come onto the property and hunt and fish on the property. The 12,000 acre phase one already has a series of 20 miles of roads where the gates are open and people are able to travel on those. And then the second part, when we get phase two done, which will be sometime late next year or early 2024, we'll have another 50 miles of of roads where people can access the property for 6 months of the year on those roads. So skiing, biking, in the wintertime, there's snowmobiling on some designated trails. We are working with a local ATV club right now to designate an ATV-UTV trail. It's really quite open for all sorts of different recreational uses.
Clint, thank you for joining us.
You betcha, Kate. I appreciate the time.
Clint Miller is Central Midwest Regional Director for the Conservation Fund, talking about Pelican River Forest, the 70,000 acres east of Rhinelander. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here is producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Cuban refugee who lives in La Crosse. He's also one of the people featured in a new podcast to check out, WPR Reports Uprooted.
A group of musicians are jamming in their living room in La Crosse. One of the musicians playing is a Cuban exile who arrived in Wisconsin following the Mariel boat lift in 1980.
Okay, well, my full name is Marcos Andres Hernandez Calderon. Very, very long name. I have to deal with that for the rest of my life.
Marcos was born in 1957 and grew up in Havana. And when he was about 12, he got paid to wash and park cars across from the luxurious Hotel Capri.
And they have a garage in there. And I got together with a lot of all those older people. And they play chess and dominoes and all kinds of things. So they were paying me, you know. It probably was, if I remember, 35, 40 cents, something like that, for washing the car. But I get to drive it. And my dad was helping me steering and all that. And after that, I love driving.
As he got older, he wanted to really hit the road. Marcos dreamed of traveling, visiting countries around the world. But he couldn't, because in the 1960s and 70s, President Fidel Castro placed tough restrictions on leaving Cuba.
You cannot leave the country to visit anywhere, to come here and go back. And they want for Fidel Castro, the communists take over, and then Cuba become a prison. That's what I like to say about that.
Then 1980 hit. Castro changed course and allowed residents to leave the island for the United States from April to October. Marcos and 125,000 other people saw this, the Mariel boat lift, as their opportunity to get out of Cuba.
My mother was the first one who told me, you better get out here because you have no future here.
Marcos hopped on a boat, heartbroken that he was leaving his family. He landed in Florida and was quickly whisked away to Wisconsin, where he joined almost 15,000 other Cuban refugees at Fort McCoy in Sparta. He was there for less than a month when he eventually moved in with a family of farmers before moving out on his own. And he got a job with his first love, cars.
I drive many different type of transportation out there. I drive for handicap buses and vans and limousines.
But then in 1988, Marcos got caught with drugs. That conviction sent him to prison, and it's still impacting his life today.
We were not aware of the consequences, you know. Say we were thinking of the money, you know, just like pretty much everybody until you get caught. I still paying for that mistake, you know. They got me under the...
Because of that mistake, a felony conviction, he cannot become a permanent resident or citizen of the United States.
1991, I got out. And since then, all I have done is work, and no crime, nothing, and no second chance.
And the hardest thing for him, He can't get a passport to travel the world or visit his family in Cuba, people he hasn't seen in more than 40 years.
If I have the chance to go back home, you know, the person will be going to the cemetery where my mother is buried and giving my, you know.
Living in legal limbo for decades has been difficult for Marcos and many of his other Cuban friends who arrived in Wisconsin in 1980.
Enough is enough for people that pretty much has been in this country more than they have been in their own country. I want people to hear a voice. I want people to know they... I did have a dream to come to this country and go pretty much to everywhere in the whole world, you know. That dream is still pending, you know.
To learn more about Marcos's life in Cuba and Wisconsin, and to find out why his desire to return home is urgent, check out the new podcast, WPR Reports Uprooted. All 8 episodes can be found at WPR.org/uprooted. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to RSV and why this respiratory illness is on the rise in Wisconsin and across the nation. RSV stands for respiratory syncytial virus. It's been in the news lately because doctors see many more cases than normal this time of year. It usually circulates from late December to mid-February, according to the CDC, causing more than 2 million children under age 5 to go see the doctor. And each year, RSV leads to tens of thousands of hospitalizations for this age group. Join in on RSV, 800-642-1234. Dr. Raj Nayak is a pediatrician at Gunderson Health System on the board of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Nayak, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. WPR was in contact yesterday afternoon with the State Health Department to get the latest numbers, and we learned 1,280 cases of RSV were identified last week in Wisconsin compared to 810 the previous week, and DHS told us they expect those numbers to rise. So, you know, with Gunderson, with clinics and hospitals across 3 different states, what are you seeing at hospitals in your system?
Yeah, we're certainly starting to see a rise in the number of cases, not unexpectedly. The reports of cases on the East Coast were rising for several weeks. And so there's usually a spread across the country in a predictable pattern. So we've been expecting the rise here in the Midwest for a number of weeks.
What are common symptoms of RSV? What is it like?
Yeah, it has quite a range of symptoms. For the people that are not as susceptible, it's probably going to just look like a very bad cold. So lots of runny nose, congestion, cough. But there are certain populations, particularly younger children, and especially those that have some risk factors like prematurity or forms of congenital heart disease, that may be more severely affected. And then there's adults that are in the elderly population or more at risk for respiratory illness that are also at risk for significant consequences. So you can think of this infection as one that affects the two spectrums of age.
How does RSV spread, and why in the winter months or the cooler times of year?
Yeah, so it's respiratory droplet spread, which means that it's the small little droplets produced by coughing or sneezing that predominantly spread this infection. This is a respiratory virus like many others that has a seasonal epidemic pattern. And the most common times, and you mentioned it in your opening, that it's typically a wintertime buyers, but there are some years where it starts in the fall and some that continues even into the later spring. So obviously when we're in colder climates indoors, we tend to spread more respiratory infections because we're in closer contact with one another.
I wonder, is RSV contagious before the symptoms develop?
Yeah, you know, the like a lot of viruses, there is a contagious period. The early, it might be a little bit infectious right before, but certainly during the early phase of illness, it's also quite infectious. And it is, it's so infectious that, you know, if you look at children, pretty much by the age of 2 years, all children have had at least one RSV infection. I should have mentioned earlier that some of the severe complications, so these susceptible children, what it happens is it causes inflammation in the little small airways that lead down to the lungs. And in those susceptible children, then it can cause more severe respiratory illness, including wheezing, you know, some respiratory distress where they need oxygen or other support. And so that's the risk is that these lower respiratory tract infections can end up being quite severe, leading to hospitalization or worse.
Yes. At what point, when these what seem like basic cold-like symptoms really escalate, what symptoms mean a child should visit the pediatrician?
Yeah, I usually talk about it in three basic severe symptoms that should prompt a visit. One is if they have feeding troubles. Sometimes the children are working so hard to breathe that they can't feed well and they become dehydrated. The second is if they have enough distress where they're working extra hard to breathe and they just need extra support, including oxygen or other support. And then the third, which happens in the smallest babies, is called apnea, where there's a pause in their breathing, of course, a longer pause than normal, where these apneic episodes can lead to much more severe consequences. So those are the three most severe symptoms that I would say prompt immediate evaluation.
Can the coughing and wheezing from RSV, can that lead to other complications or longer-term breathing problems?
Yeah, there are a percentage of children that have these early wheezing illnesses that, and this is included with RSV as well as other respiratory infections, that go on to have chronic wheezing, and ultimately some of them go on to have asthma. So that's a known association with a lot of early respiratory illnesses.
So if the infant, the baby, or the toddler is hospitalized, what is a standard treatment of care for RSV?
Yeah, for treatment, there is no cure. The typical treatment is really just supportive care. And so that could include things like hydration with an IV, so intravenous hydration. It can include oxygen or other respiratory support. In the most severe cases, they may need mechanical ventilation. But really, we just support them through until they can recover on their own.
Pediatrician Raj Nayak here with what we need to know about the respiratory illness RSV, with severe cases and hospitalizations rising. Join in on RSV, now the leading cause of infant hospitalizations in our country. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Recent data in the Journal of Infectious Diseases cites RSV as the leading cause of hospitalizations during the respiratory season for infants and young children. And now a maternal RSV vaccine is showing promise in Pfizer clinical trials and could be on the horizon. Still time to talk about the respiratory illness RSV, 800-642-1234. Gunderson Health System pediatrician Raj Nayak stays with us. Let's bring in Elizabeth in Wauwatosa. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. My daughter, back in 2008, she was a preemie. She was born at 32 weeks. And she was born in July, so with talking with the pediatrician, we were definitely going to be getting the RSV shot. We were lucky that a traveling nurse came each month to give her the little shot in her leg, but it was really difficult to have it approved through insurance. It's my understanding that each shot or each immunization is quite expensive, and back in 2008, they only approved 3 shots for her. And it was quite a battle with the insurance company to have them approve an October shot in addition to November, December, and January, and then even to approve a February, and I think I got a March shot out of there too. But it was quite a difficult time advocating through the insurance company. Is that still accurate now, and what's some direction on that?
Elizabeth, thank you so much. Elizabeth, I think talking about an antiviral for the premature infant, Dr. Nayak?
Well, actually what she's talking about is a monoclonal antibody, which is different than an antiviral medication. And it's called palivizumab. And it has been around for a while. And it was a very astute question because it is still a challenge. The recommendations, because of the expense of this antibodies, are still limited to very high-risk populations of infants. And it does require a monthly injection. And really, when we're talking about these monoclonal antibodies, what they offer is something we call passive protection, which means you're actually giving antibodies that protect for the duration that they last. And you're not actually inducing the person that receives it to make their own antibodies. And so it is expensive. Insurance hurdles still exist to some degree, and they're limited to the highest risk children. But there is help on the way in terms of new scientific advances that hopefully are not too far around the corner, which could include other types of monoclonal antibodies that perhaps are going to be a little less expensive. And then the potential for true vaccines against RSV, which really will be a big help in the fight against RSV.
Yes, Elizabeth, thank you, because I think that is a perfect segue for this maternal RSV vaccine could be available, Pfizer said, as soon as next winter, and it would be given to pregnant people to protect children for the first 6 months of life. What impact could this potential new vaccine have on RSV spread?
Yeah, I think this is really helpful. So when we look at the most at-risk children, so there are children that die of RSV, and most of them are under the age of 6 months. And so what this study showed in the New England Journal of Medicine published this spring is that when this candidate vaccine was given to pregnant women between 24 and 36 weeks of gestation, they were actually able to pass on antibodies to their newborns that lasted at least 6 months and provided good protective levels of antibody response in those infants. So it really offers the potential to give this vaccine to late pregnancy women and protect their infants through this highest risk time. The other thing that we know about giving vaccines to mothers is, and this hasn't been shown yet, but we can hope for something we call cocooning, which is if you protect the people around the infants, particularly mothers, you can help protect the child by not allowing the mother to get infection as well. So I think there's two potential advantages to that strategy.
Talking about RSV and respiratory illnesses this season, Dr. Raj Nayak, pediatrician at Gunderson Health System. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Nayak, if RSV is related to the flu virus, and there's COVID circulating out there in the community and at daycare and so forth. How should a parent react when their child falls ill or shows symptoms of something in their environment? What would be a parent's next steps?
Particularly challenging time. And, first of all, I wouldn't say they're related, but they're coexisting at the same time. And I think it is a challenging time for parents because influenza is out there right now, RSV at higher rates than average at this time of year. And then there are still COVID infections out there. And so you don't know which is which. And fortunately, testing has been readily available. And this is an occasion where in past years, we would say, unless you have severe illness, you probably don't need to test for RSV or influenza, or unless you're high risk individual, you don't need to test. But these days with COVID, RSV and influenza, I expect that we'll be doing more testing than we would typically to try to sort it out and prevent spread.
Nick emailed along those lines to ask, how can this impact people if they're COVID positive and have RSV?
Yeah, I think that remains to be determined, but we're certainly concerned about that. I think for several years or since the onset of the pandemic, there have been experts forecasting the possibilities of twindemic, or in this case, triple-demic, and they hadn't yet come to be. We were doing other things, basic public health measures like more of the masking and distancing that maybe prevented those things from occurring. But I think certainly as people are acting more normally in society and doing less masking and certainly the distancing, there's potential for co-infections and more severe symptoms related to having multiple of these infections. So it is a risk and something we'll have to see how it goes as the season plays out.
As the season plays out, we only have a few moments left, but what are you expecting from this year's flu season? The State Health Department says less than 12% of children under age 17 have gotten the flu vaccine this year.
Yeah, I am concerned about the slower rates of influenza vaccine administration. I'm hopeful that we can continue to spread the message and try to get people to do flu vaccine. Of course, we know it's not perfect, but it is a layer of protection that's important for everybody eligible, who includes everybody 6 months of age and older. So we'd highly encourage that. I know there's been some carryover of vaccine hesitancy related to people's feelings around COVID vaccine, but our goal is to keep everybody as healthy as possible. So I would strongly encourage everybody to get their flu vaccine if eligible to try to prevent people from suffering the consequences of these respiratory infections.
Dr. Nayak, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Raj Nayak is a pediatrician at Gunderson Health System. He's on the board for the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.